Hello, welcome to Media Talk. I'm Matt Wells. Pest and panned is the media coverage of the banking crisis making things worse.
What it really amounted to was Royal Bank of Scotland, Barclays and Lloyds TSB telling him to pull his finger out and get on and come up with a rescue plan.
Crunch time for ITV. Will viewers be swamped by American levels of advertising?
I mean, anything they can do that gives them an extra cushion has got to be a good thing.
And horror of horrors, Charlie Brooker's latest TV project. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Emily Bell, The Guardian's Director of Digital Content, is here. Hello, Emily. Are you feeling numerate this week?
I'm feeling numerate.
Good.
And insolvent.
And we also have the Observer's media editor, another business journalist, James Robinson. Hello to you. Have you got your calculator out?
Yes, I have. I'll need it.
Yeah, I think we will need it. Well, the banks seized up, credit markets crunched, and finally the government announced a master plan, which, like all good plans, seemed to be hatched late at night over takeaway curry. But do you know how much that curry cost?
£243.
It was from
Gandhi's, my local curry house. A fine establishment.
I thought we'd actually missed a decimal point off when I looked at it on the website this morning. I thought they meant £24.30.
Not 2,430.
No, but that's a lot of
numbers.
There's a lot of people in the treasury.
All right, we'll come to that. But were they bounced into it by irresponsible reporting?
Well, what it really amounted to was Royal Bank of Scotland, Barclays, and Lloyds TSB telling him to pull his finger out and get on and come up with a rescue plan. To be clear, Jim, the other banks were represented there too, HBOS and HSBC. But it was these three who, in a sense, dominated debate. They are the most UK-focused of, in a sense, the big banks left standing, because HBOS, of course, is being taken over by Lloyds TSB. And I think what probably surprised the Chancellor was, you know, that they said, actually, you know, we hear that you're working on a plan to inject capital into us, get a move on. And I mean, they were slightly surprised that in fact the Chancellor didn't present them with more detail of precisely what it is that the Treasury has been working on.
That was the ubiquitous BBC business editor Robert Peston, of course, and it was that report on the Today programme on Tuesday morning that led to criticism from the City and headlines like, "Does this man have too much power?" Copyright the Daily Mail. Kim Fletcher is a wise old Fleet Street bird, former editor of the Independent on Sunday and ex-executive editor of The Telegraph, and this is what he had to say.
It's one of the big questions with journalists. Sometimes they need to ask themselves, why is someone telling me this? And the problem with Robert at the moment, are people telling him things for their own ends, and he's doing what journalists do, which is go out and tell the world? And I'm not sure whether journalists are meant to stop and pause and say, well, is this in global interests, or is it merely in the interest of journalism?
Because once somebody has told you something, whoever it is and whatever their motives are, it's very difficult, if as a journalist, not to report that fact, especially if it's something cataclysmic like, you know, a major high street bank going under.
That's right, and I think it'd be a terrible thing, and it's a terrible thing in general if journalists start being told things and then they decide, I'm not sure if I'm going to tell the outside world. I like the idea of journalists just running out and telling the world whatever they've been told, if it's true. But it is more complicated here. You know, because it then raises a question, which I think the Mail was raising. Are people telling him things to get rumours out into the market and actually to accelerate the process? So it's our journalists being used as part of the process.
The process is very interesting. And I guess maybe the thing with Robert Peston is that the fact that he's on so often, and because he's on such high-profile programmes like the Today, starting off at the Today programme and ending with the 10 o'clock news, because he seems to be the only voice at the BBC that's talking about this, maybe that gives him disproportionate power.
Well, it does give him huge power. I was told the other day that the dealing room has now cut off access to other news sources. All they want is a constant Peston feed, because they think the Peston feed is giving them raw information faster than the existing financial feeds. I think he must be knackered as well, because as you say, you know, you go to bed listening to Peston, you wake up listening to Peston, so I don't know if he is getting any sleep. And he's got a big brain, but it does need to be shut down sometimes for purely for rest reasons.
Yeah, we need a Peston holiday perhaps, don't we? What about the papers? I mean, there's maybe a bit of, but I mentioned the Mail. journalists are always jealous of other journalists who do better than them. Perhaps there is a bit of that going on there, plus add in a bit of BBC bashing as well. But how have the papers been reporting this crisis?
Well, by and large, I think pretty well, because the problem with this crisis is none of us really understands. I mean, the people at the heart of the crisis don't really understand how serious it is.
So God help the journalists.
No, exactly. So I think it's very hard for journalists. I mean, journalists famously don't really understand numbers. City journalists sometimes understand numbers, but they're about the only ones that do. And we're now in the hands of, in effect, city journalists who are telling us it's all right, it's not all right. And, you know, day by day, we're not really sure.
And the trouble is, of course, is that the city journalists tend to sit down the other end of the office,
yep,
and are not that well known, frankly, but, you know, by the editor often.
That is absolutely right. And we're all claiming now to understand the city. We never did. And a lot of us didn't read the city pages very closely. Now, that's changing. You know, the other day, my wife used the word liquidity about our circumstances. I think it was a lack of liquidity. But,
right,
you know, the idea that liquidity is now creeping into the domestic consciousness shows how things are changing. But for years, most journalists didn't really read the city pages.
No, you were saying in your column, weren't you, that the only connection or importance that city journalists had was at the proprietors' summer party, because...
Well, this was the thing. Proprietors, in my view, started to love city journalists because proprietors like city. They like business. And suddenly they could meet city journalists who actually could talk to them in their language. And they weren't meeting journalists who wanted to talk about why they needed more money or wasn't this a beautifully written piece. They were talking to city journalists who understood the city and talked the language of money. And that's what proprietors really like.
Is this why, then, that that city journalists tend to do well in the Murdoch empire? Because if you're a city journalist, you can talk to Rupert.
Well, that's my view. I mean, I'm talking as a non-city journalist, and therefore I've always regarded with envy the fact that city journalists have managed to get FaceTime with proprietors. And I put it down to the fact that they can talk the language of the city. And the crucial thing, if you can get FaceTime, obviously you can then impress yourself on the proprietor and say what a great guy you are.
Do you think that when it all dies down, that we will continue to report the city and the financial story better, that there'll be a long-term upside for this, or will the city journalists get back to be banished down to the other end of the office again?
I'd like to say that we're all going to be better informed and that we're all going to take an interest. History suggests that once this is over, and admittedly it now maybe looks like years rather than months, once it's over, we'll all go back to our own ways and want football and sex.
Kim Fletcher talking to me earlier there. Emily, what do you think? Let's start off with Peston, and let's try not to think of Peston and sex in the same breath. What do you think? Has he got too much power?
No, I think that this is journalists talking about another journalist in terms which are completely inappropriate for the circumstances. This is not about us guys. It's about something else completely happening out there. I think Peston's actually done a magnificent job. I know why there is talk around this, and I think it emanates from when he broke the Northern Rock story. And I think there were lots of questions at the time about where that story came from, how it found its way onto the BBC, and what the immediate impact of that was, which was actually queues outside banks. And one could say that the press management of that story was spectacularly poor. But that's not Peston's fault. Again, you know, what he is, he's the lightning rod of information to the outside world, that he's doing his job. But he doesn't have disproportionate power because he himself is not moving markets or even precipitating the collapse of the Icelandic banking system.
James, do you think that if you're a financial journalist like Robert Peston or whoever, and you get given information that's as cataclysmic as that, that you have a responsibility to think about why is this, as Kim Fletcher was saying, why is this person telling me this?
Yes, you do, but you should publish it, shouldn't you? Your first instinct should be to get it out there.
Because once you've got it, you can't keep on.
There is something about the provenance of the information, because if you're being told by city spivs who are shorting shares that a certain company is in danger, of course, you're going to take that into account and say, they're only telling me this, so I'll issue write a false story about a particular company. But if the story's true and it checks out, and Robert Peston's got unrivaled, really, contacts in government as well as in the city, absolutely you should publish it. And in terms of whether Peston has been responsible or not, he certainly has been, because after that Northern Rock story, pretty much every story he subsequently wrote about any individual bank, he prefaced it with a paragraph or a sentence which said, I should emphasise that there is no danger this bank will collapse. Hmm. There is no way the government would allow that to happen. Therefore, there's no point in you going out and trying to withdraw your money. So I think he's been brilliant for city journalism, city journalists.
Is Kim Fletcher right, Emily, to say that most journalists are not financially, haven't got the brains to cope with this story, is what he's saying?
Speaking as a former business journalist, I would say yes, he's absolutely right. And there's no, I think that it is certainly the case that it is an incredibly difficult story to understand, even for the people absolutely at the heart of it.
You need a great degree of financial literacy.
Well, you need a huge degree of financial literacy, and not just that, but also a huge degree of understanding of financial markets and the instruments that move them. That said, I think that there are elements of the press which have done extraordinarily well in the past months and indeed years. If you look at Gillian Tett of the Financial Times and Martin Wolf, their key commentator, if you look at columnists like Alex Brummer or our own Larry Elliott, etc. You know, these are the themes which are coming out now are themes which all of these journalists have talked at length and eloquently about for years. The issue is where those insights connect to the rest of the world. So how does that connect to Channel 4 doing property shows? How does it connect to us having money sections about where to invest your money, etc.? And I do think that it's really hard. It's the hardest thing for the press, which is how do you play stories with high impact and low probability? I mean, I remember when I was on The Observer where Peter Beaumont probably talked about this bloke called Bin Laden every other week for about sort of 5 years.
Distinguished foreign correspondent.
The 11th. Yeah,
no,
exactly.
Peter Beaumont, at the
time was our security correspondent, and say, you know, the noises around Al-Qaeda, etc. You could almost see people around the conference table, not exactly tuning out, but sort of struggling to understand how you'd surface these stories and make them important. And the fact is, of course, you know, that the collapse makes the story immediate. But nobody could have predicted that. Central bankers didn't correctly predict it. Lehman Brothers didn't correctly predict it. What chance the financial press?
So the problem, James, is that the story up until about a year or so ago was counterintuitive, so that the people who were writing it and talking about it weren't getting space or time or impact.
Yeah, I think there's a problem with city journalism. Actually, it's very complicated. You do need, dare I say it, to be, you know, it's a hard thing to understand, you know. And there's always a sense that if it's a big enough story, it will go onto the news pages. But now I think there's a sense of, well, perhaps more on Sunday papers, but what's the human interest angle? Hmm. Well, actually, the more interesting angle is the financial angle. There's a temptation to stick all the financial stuff in the business section and say, oh, send someone to Iceland. And I think, I mean, it's interesting because if Karl Marx was alive today, the first thing he'd do would be to read the FT and read the business pages, regardless of whether there was a credit crunch or not. And I think there is a certain inverted snobbery almost about publications, particularly on the left. They wear their financial ignorance as a badge of honour. You know,
I think it's more than that. I think it's also that you are trying to hold an audience and engage people. And actually, until the impact hits you, that it's very difficult at conveying complex stories to people when they really don't quite understand how it connects to their daily lives. So I think quite a lot of personal finance sections were saying about a year ago, you know, don't go for these sort of dodgy mortgages which are five times your income. I mean, I don't think that there were many parts of the actual responsible national press saying, borrow as much money as you can now, because clearly everything is going to be all right. Yeah. But the projection of that can sort of, it does get lost at the front of the papers, because there are more urgent and seemingly relevant things happening every day.
I just think James has just come up with a brilliant ad campaign for the Financial Times. A big picture of Karl Marx. If he was alive today, he'd be reading the FT. Excellent. Well, there's lots more great business writing, of course, at guardian.co.uk/business. If you want to leave a comment on this or any of the other stories that we're discussing this week, go to guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. I'm Matt Wells. This is Media Talk. Coming up,
it's schlock. It's unashamed populist schlock. The original model for the show was 24. I was watching 24 and I thought the terrorists are ridiculous in this. They should replace them with something more interesting like zombies. I'm a big zombie fan. And then a few weeks later I was watching Big Brother and I thought, ooh, that's the perfect setting.
Charlie Brooker on his new horror show. But first, there are some grim jokes doing the rounds in the Square Mile. How about this one? How do you define an optimist? A banker who irons five shirts on Sunday evenings.
Oh, very good.
Very good. But the media industry is facing an uncertain future of its own. Job cuts and budgets are being slashed right across Fleet Street. TV channels are pleading with regulators for the right to show more ads. And newsrooms are getting by with a minimum of resources. Here's media analyst Alex de Groot of Panmure Gordon.
Well, if we're talking about share price performance, then in recent weeks the sector's probably been hit slightly harder than the market. If we're talking about financial performance, we'll get a pretty good steer in coming weeks, because we'll have either IMS updates, effectively trading updates, or proper results. So we'll get a pretty good steer from the corporates themselves shortly.
What sort of media companies are most at risk, do you think, in the coming months and year or so?
Well, in simple terms, we classify the sector, you know, B2B, business to business, or business to consumer. So B2B or B2C. Arguably, B2C is early cycle and gets the pain first. And so companies like the newspaper companies and the TV companies have been experiencing the pain probably since Q1 this year. So it's already been going on for a while. So we know that trend. B2B, business to business, is classically late cycle. So those guys, typically conference organizations or journal producers, will tend to be late cycle, and they should be start to feel the pain sort of nowish, really.
So that's why, I guess, we're seeing cuts, job cuts at places like Trinity Mirror and ITV. Is that right?
Yes. The operating environment is very, very tough. It's been deteriorating all year. Hopefully we're bottoming out about now, but yeah, they're sort of thinking through their budgets for next year. You know, as you know, corporates typically start their 09 budgets in October, November. So that's why the job cut's happening now.
Right. So what do you make, I wanted to ask you specifically about ITV, they're lobbying Ofcom for more advertising minutes in peak time, aren't they?
Is
that a wise move, do you think?
Yes. I mean, you know, as broadcasting is their major revenue stream, i.e. advertising, anything that they can do to sort of ensure that they get better advertising revenues has got to be good for them. There's a more broad question, of course, about, you know, should ITV be more lightly regulated? But specifically on advertising, yes. I mean, anything they can do that gives them an extra cushion has got to be a good thing, because, you know, the underlying fundamentals on UK advertising are obviously quite weak at the moment.
Isn't there a danger there that if your only answer is to increase the amount of advertising, that you actually devalue the advertising itself?
In terms of minutage, yes. I mean, I seem to recall that Capital, for example, played around with their minutage policy quite a lot, and it was basically unsuccessful. However, I mean, I think you've got to recognise that the biggest revenue driver for ITV is advertising performance. So they have to do what they think they can do to optimise that. Classified advertising has been particularly weak, but display has actually held up a little bit better. I think the acid test will be in coming weeks. Retail category is massively important for traditional media companies. It's only latterly, I think, that the retail sector itself has sort of started to experience the pain.
Alex de Groot there. Let's take this question of TV advertising first, James. Is this a slippery slope to American-style broadcasting, you know, just loads of ad breaks and the occasional programme?
Possibly so, but who cares, really? I mean, I think ITV should be allowed to have as many adverts as it wants, because it will only show, or maybe I'm being naive, but it will only show as many adverts as the consumers and the viewers are prepared to watch, in my view. There is a natural limit to the amount of adverts people will put up with in this country, and that's what will dictate how many adverts they put on they're free from the regulators.
Are you a free marketeer, as free marketeer as James is, Emily?
Yeah, I think that Ofcom is sharpening the knife so that ITV can cut its own throat. I mean, I do think that there's a massive brand issue if you're ITV and you're up against BBC One at the moment, if you're stuffing your programmes with more ads, and you're inevitably going to be doing that at a slightly lower spot rate than if the commodity is rarer. And I think if I was ITV, I would really be wanting to do everything I could to attract an audience. An audience is not going to be attracted by more advertising. Mm. I mean, they are in a bind, because I don't really know what else they can do at this point, but it does feel to me like kind of an absolute sort of hitting a death spiral.
What about newspapers, James? Is it likely that we're going to see any closures? We'll see some closures in the regional sector, bound.
Certainly, we already have, haven't we? But, and we'll see more, I'm sure. I mean, in nationals, it's never ceases to amaze me how, yeah, we just have too many newspapers in this country, and people have said that for years, and Murdoch's famously said it for a long time. You have to think that if there's a, you know, there's an argument over whether there's a structural advertising decline or a cyclical advertising decline. Well, now I think there's both, or there will be both. And you wonder how papers, I think we all know the papers that are most vulnerable, I won't name them in case I ever want to work on one of those titles,
which is always
yes, Sunday People. Yeah, you have to think that one of those papers is going to be closed before it just goes bust. I mean, you really wouldn't be surprised to see that.
And in other newspapers, the ones that survive, Emily, there's bound to be, there already is, cost-cutting and the possibility that expensive investigative journalism will go by the board.
I think we're entering 2 or 3 years, the like of which none of us will have seen in our professional careers. Mm. I think that it's going to be unbelievably bloody, and I think the idea that maybe one title or two titles will close, I wouldn't be surprised to see half a dozen close. I really wouldn't. I think it's going to be absolutely extraordinary.
That bad?
Yeah, I do think so, because James is absolutely right. It's the cyclical and it's the systemic. It's both at the same time. And there's always been a sort of a point where actually if advertising has really dipped and you've had a sort of a competitive market, that people will still put silly money into newspapers. Well, where are they going to borrow the money from? Or, you know, if they have the money already, there are going to be so many sort of other things for multimillionaires and billionaires to worry about, that I think the attraction now, I've always thought that people would always invest in the press, and now for the first time I sort of don't think they will. And you could easily take six titles out of the UK market and say, well, that leaves us with what looks like a much more rational market
but,
for the future.
But as James said, we've been talking about the possibility of newspapers folding for years, and they never have. They're remarkably resilient.
But we've never seen this. You see, we've never seen this before. If you look at the Monday to Friday sort of average declines in circulation over the last or 3 or 4 years, it's actually been running at about 5% a year rather than the sort of 1 to 2 to 3% of the preceding 5 years and the sort of 2% of the preceding decade. So the rate of decline of sale is much greater now. It's a discretionary spend for most people, newspapers.
And yeah, it doesn't help when they're putting their prices up either, does it?
No.
Or it might be, it's very good value at 80p.
Still only 80p.
Well, it's still only 80p, but I think, you know, the pricing issue is going to be a really crucial one, which if you haven't put your price up now, Would you dare do it?
James, is the internet going to save newspapers? It doesn't look like it because internet advertising seems to be starting to flatline, doesn't it?
Well, that's what I was going to say, that'll be the interesting thing, what happens to internet advertising. Well, the rate of growth has slowed. I mean, I think that's right.
Perhaps I exaggerated.
But the rate of growth has seemingly slowed, so I think that's going to be the most interesting thing.
What's happened to... Sorry, I'm gurning at Matt when he goes, it's flatlining. No! The year-on-year growth is much lower than it was, and it's probably sort of around about sort of 16 to 20% for media brands. It's higher than that, I think, in search. And, you know, again, Google continues to pick up ads. And actually, in classified online, classifieds at the moment are remarkably healthy, and they're still up sort of 30% year-on-year or something like
Thank
that.
Thank God for that, eh?
But, you know, you're talking about a much lower base, and you're not talking about the cost bases in the existing offline parts of the business coming down at the same rate. So it's going to be a really horrible year.
All right. Sounds as if it's going to be pretty nasty. If you want to keep up with the nastiness, it's all at mediaguardian.co.uk.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
Now, he's best known for his TV show and Guardian columns that lay into the worst excesses and clichés of modern television. But Charlie Brooker was a writer for television before becoming a writer about it. And he's got a new drama series which starts on E4 in a few weeks. And basically, it's a zombie horror show set in the Big Brother house.
This is Davina. You have 30 seconds to say your goodbyes. I'm coming to get you!
Is that Davina?
So off.
Pretty gory stuff. Now, the press launch was this week, and I went along to talk to Brooker. I asked him first to explain his series, which is called Dead Set, for podcast listeners.
No, fuck the listeners to the podcast. Yes, it's... no, I'm sorry. Welcome, the listeners. It's schlock. It's unashamed populist schlock. It's... The original model for the show was 24. I was watching 24 and I thought the terrorists are ridiculous in this. They should replace them with something more interesting like zombies. I'm a big zombie fan. And then a few weeks later I was watching Big Brother and I thought, ooh, that's the perfect setting, in the way that in Dawn of the Dead, the original Dawn of the Dead, a shopping mall was the perfect setting. What better setting could there be for what essentially becomes a siege movie than the Big Brother house? So... that's what it is. It's not The Wire. I mean, I'm known for championing things like The Wire. You couldn't get more far removed from The Wire than this. This is unashamedly populist, but at the same time, hopefully, also really extreme and appalling.
It's hard to ask this question without inviting the obvious joke, but there's not a lot of horror on television. Why is that?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. Because the minute I'd sort of had the idea, it wouldn't go away. Because I just kept thinking, I don't think there's been a zombie TV show, certainly before. And there hasn't been that much horror. And I used to love things like Hammer House of Horror, you know, and also things like Tales of the Unexpected and the Twilight Zone, which delved into horror a lot and gave you a real... You know, there's some really chilling, nihilistic stories going on there. You don't often see those sorts of things. You get the ghost stories for Christmas that they sometimes do, and BBC Four, I know, has revived some of those. But you don't get that much nihilistic unpleasantness and horror on TV. Not enough, certainly, apart from on the news. So I thought it was time that, you know, that we had something more like that on screen. In fact, weirdly, the only show that comes close to doing kind of horror, really, I think, has been Doctor Who, when it's done like out-and-out horror episodes, like Blink, which is an amazing episode. You know, that's the sort of nerve you want to tickle.
Do you have to follow horror rules when you do horror? I noticed that particular rule that you have is that to kill the zombies, you have to bash them about the head. Is that a rule in horror?
There are some certain rules with zombies, yes, definitely. One thing also is nobody in the show ever refers to them as zombies. That's another very important rule. And they don't know the rules in advance. It's not like Scream or all postmodern where they go, oh, this is a bit like Dawn of the Dead, basically. We were keen to differentiate ourselves from things like Shaun of the Dead, which was another... I mean, we're a comedy, horror, thriller sort of mix, and that was too. But in that, you know, and I loved Shaun of the Dead, but in that they were kind of aware that they were in a zombie film. So we were keen to do something slightly different where, you know, they take it seriously within the situation. Obviously, our zombies run, and I know that George Romero, who's kind of the godfather of zombie movies, has been very critical of the modern trend for running zombies, because he says that if a zombie ran, its ankles would break because of rigor mortis. But frankly, you're talking about someone that's come back from the dead, so you're not really within the realms of documentary. So, with all due respect, fuck what he thinks.
Do you have, obviously, you spend a large part of your career is as a critic. Mm. Now, do you expect, as a critic and then as a writer, for your work, your television work, to be criticised disproportionately because of that?
Probably to some extent, and that's probably a bit of a shame. I think people, you know, I don't think people should have, in a large sense, my involvement with this is kind of a red herring, in a way, for what the actual show is, I think. I mean, you know, if people come to it and overthink everything that's going on, I think they've probably come away slightly confused. I don't really know. I mean, it's difficult because I was sort of working in telly before I was writing about it. And so, you know, obviously I've done other things. You know, I did Nathan Barley. We got some negative press for that. And I never sort of thought, oh, people are having a go because I've been involved. I think they just sort of didn't get it. And then obviously it came out on DVD and picked up and everybody realised that we were right and they were completely wrong. But no, I don't know. I mean, hopefully people will totally ignore my name in the credits and kind of make of it what they will. And really, with something like this, it's such a huge collaboration. It's really more down to, you know, the cast and, you know, the Maggie Bowden, the script editor, was, you know, a massive help to me because I've not written something like this before. Jan Demange, the director, did an amazing job, I think, of doing something, because we had, you know, the budget for a digital TV show and we were trying to make something that kind of felt like a film. And I really think he pulled it off. I think he's done an amazing job. And he had a lot of input in the way the thing was shaped as well. He came in, because I'd written the first two episodes when we got him on board, and he came in, he read the first episode, he loved it, he read the second episode, and he was kind of like, what's this? This is rubbish. Well, he was effectively sort of said it was rubbish. And I was like, who the fuck's this guy? But it sort of spurred you on, and you end up, you know, just kind of rewriting it. So he was a massive influence over how the whole thing went. So if it's a success, it's really, you know, not down to me in any way. And if it's a massive failure, it's not down to me either.
I was going to say, I think you meant to say that the other way around.
Yeah. Yeah. No, both. Although, yeah, no, if it's a massive failure, I'll commit suicide.
All right.
No,
I guess it depends who's doing the criticising, because, you know, you might take particular pleasure from being criticised by the Daily Mail, for example.
I suppose I might do, but I hope they like it, and then it basically changes their entire worldview, and then they commit suicide. I don't know. No, I mean, hopefully they'll like it. It's weird. I'm not sort of... I didn't write it with any particular person in mind, I suppose. I was just kind of, you know, I know that's a cliche, writing to please yourself, but I really was. I think there's a lot of TV these days is fashioned towards a demographic. And I know this is going out on E4, which is obviously a youth skewed channel, but, you know, I'm 37. I'm not a youth by any stretch of the imagination. I'm a tottering old man, and I'd watch it.
I was going to say, you mentioned television and demographics. There's a lot of that now. You've been being a critic for a while. Do you get the impression that television is broadly, I know it's a terrible question to ask, broadly better or worse since you started out as a critic?
Oh, it's a difficult one. Actually, I would say in the last few years, there's been, I think certainly when I started around 2000, there was a massive explosion of reality shows, and everybody was, that was the new thing. You know, and they were fine for a while, but then there were so many of them, and they were getting commissioned ahead of other things. And I think people got a bit, you know, tired of it, basically. And now you've seen a research. I think you can't. It's difficult to underestimate the influence that the revival of Doctor Who had. I think that's really important. And that was a real populist show that appealed to a huge range of people, and really sort of shifted the landscape. I think in a way, you know, showed that there was an appetite for drama that wasn't just about child abuse and sink estates, basically. You know, the decent drama didn't have to be about those sorts of issues. There was nothing wrong with doing big populist drama that had an idea to it that wasn't just it's set in a police station or it's set in a hospital.
You mentioned Doctor Who in a few of the episodes and 24. I guess we know about a lot about what you don't like because you write a lot about that. Mm-hmm. What are your influences, things that you like and your favourite stuff at the moment?
In terms of what I kind of like overall, I do like sitting down and munching my way through a massive box set of something like... I mean, Mad Men was something I picked up on belatedly after it had been out on TV. I kind of got the box set because everyone was banging on about it. You know, things like that, I think, are just incredible. I think there's, in that respect, that's been a big shift in that you get more long arc stories being told now in TV. And, you know, they're richer than a lot of films. So I think in that respect, really, I don't think we've seen TV dramas of the likes of the ilk of Mad Men or The Wire or The Sopranos really before. So, you know, in that respect, TV, you could argue, is better than it's ever been. And there's also other aspects in which you could say it's kind of worse than it's ever been. It's just, I think there's more, it's kind of like America. I've just been on holiday to America, and you go to America and you think, you could be somewhere like San Francisco, which is one of the most progressive cities on earth. It's a beautiful place. There's also a massive homeless problem. And you kind of think they've got the best and the worst, you know, there's a wide extreme. And I think that's kind of where TV is at the moment.
Finally, I won't be forgiven, I don't think, if I don't ask, are you going to do anything else with Chris Morris? There have been rumours of a comedy featuring Yorkshire jihadists.
I don't know. I mean, we've been discussing some things, sort of not really connected with that, actually. Which are so amorphous at the moment that I can't really discuss them. When you're doing stuff with Chris, it's a bit like you're discussing it in the way that you might discuss any notion at 3 a.m. with anybody, and then suddenly it's sort of happening. So you never quite know at what point anything you're discussing is actually going to be. Suddenly it's like it slides into production and you didn't really notice, and then it's on air. So very possibly.
Charlie Brooker there.
Was that any good? I've not seen it. Was it good?
Well, it was amazingly. I committed the cardinal sin when I started just before I started the interview with Charlie Brooker, when he said, obviously, did you like it? And I said, yes, it's much better than I was expecting it to be.
After Nathan Barley.
Oh, no. You know, we heard him talk about Nathan Barley.
Nathan Barley. Because I say I'm the only person probably in Britain that actually liked Nathan Barley. Well, mainly because it reminded me of my daily working life.
Well, yeah. Okay. Well, this one won't. It's, yeah. Well, actually,
what,
it might.
Among the zombies,
yes, you might.
I think it's part two of my daily working life.
It is actually; it's very good. It's quite joke. I was expecting it to be jokey and Shaun of the Dead and knowing, but it's not. There are funny lines, and Davina McCall makes an appearance as a zombie herself. Well, she's obviously the host of Big Brother, and then gets turned into a zombie, which is rather alarming.
Is it profound and allegorical, Matt?
It's not that good. but yeah, I mean, it was an interesting commission because, as Angela Jane, the head of E4, told me, it's not the sort of thing you see on television very often.
It wasn't an obvious commission, but there were a couple of things at play that made it feel completely right for E4. Set in the Big Brother house, as you know, we show a lot of Big Brother, so that felt like an easy entry point. It was a horror thriller, extremely well written, with comic undertones. So it sort of was ticking lots of boxes. It was hopefully for people who like Big Brother, for people who don't like Big Brother and would be happy to see it taken over and zombies invading it and everyone in the Big Brother house being eaten up. And, you know, for horror fans, there was something there for them as well. So it just kind of felt like a sort of clever and neat commission for E4.
I guess there was a danger that it might have been none of those things, that it could have sort of fallen between all the stools.
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, sometimes you just commission, you give the producers the money and you just cross your fingers and you hope they'll come back with something good. And this time they really did come back with something even better than we hoped for. And honestly, you're right. You don't know. You know, you see a script, but, you know, a translation from script to screen is completely two different things. And it's a massive leap of faith. And I think it paid off. You know, we invested in Charlie and all those actors and the writers and the director, and they really you know, stood up to the occasion.
And I guess you say it's a leap of faith. I guess it's also it's still a leap of faith with the audience now, because there's not been this kind of show on before. The question is, will the audience be there for something that's really quite scary and gory?
But you know what? I think Eve was quite clever like that. I mean, I would say that, wouldn't I? But, you know, I think my job is to keep surprising our viewers and to hopefully give them something they think they might like or something they're not sure they'll like. But actually, when we deliver it, it's a brilliant piece of telly. So, you know, I'm really hoping it is a surprise commission. And I'm hoping that people will be surprised when they see it, but actually will be completely rewarded by the experience when they watch it.
Is it just a one-off, or is there potential, if it does go down well, as you hope, that you might be able to do more of this?
I don't know what the second series can be, Matt. What's the second series?
I don't know.
We go into the I'm a Celebrity jungle. I don't know. Who knows?
Angela Jayne and Dead Set starts on E4 later this month. My guess would be sometime around Halloween, and it'll run on 5 consecutive nights. Be afraid. Now, newspaper style guides are constantly in a state of flux. Do we use all capital letters for NATO? Is there a space in Halfwit? And is there an apostrophe in Potter's Bar? Now, the answer to all three is no, according to The Guardian's style guide. But have we banned the word grandmother? That's what The Spectator's Rod Liddle claimed in a recent article. The Guardian's style guide editor and chief sub is David Marsh. I asked him if we really had banned grannies.
No, we haven't.
So what's our position on grannies, David?
Well, all we ever said was that if using the term grandparent to describe someone, it's got to be relevant to the story. Now, clearly, there are cases when it would be. But what we were getting at was really it's the battling grannies idea, which you would see in the tabloids. And actually, we quote ourselves as an example of what not to do.
I'm glad you brought the full style guide with
in
you.
In the guide. And we said, on the front page of The Guardian, we said, with a picture, how this 55-year-old granny came to earn $25 million a year. Then you turned inside and it said, she's 5'2", she's a grandmother, and she earns $25 million a year, just in case you missed this on the front. Mm-hmm. And although that's not uninteresting and it's colourful and it's vivid description, it's pretty insulting to grandmothers, basically, and we don't think that's appropriate for The Guardian. It's as simple as that. We haven't banned the word, but that's what we've been accused of by Rod Liddle in The Spectator.
Rod Liddle, his sort of contention is that the style guide, rather than being a sensible guide of how to use English, is more a reflection of the prejudices of Guardian staff. Would you accept that criticism?
Not at all. I think that what I would concede, and I'm proud to say, that it reflects the values of The Guardian, and that's what it should be doing. And I think that we're not the only media organisation that has a style guide. Of course, everyone does, including The Spectator.
The Telegraph recently banned the word toff, didn't they?
Quite so. They did. But I think that the guide is partly about fairly mundane things, spelling, areas of grammar that people might be uncertain about. The main part is not about the values, but of course, where appropriate, we do give guidance to people. But honestly, you'd think from what Rod Liddle says and other people such as Stephen Glover, who attacked us in The Independence on Sibylla, same old grounds, we're politically correct and so on. It's just nonsense, really. We don't impose a straitjacket on our writers.
It is a bit politically correct to spell the Quran Q-U-R-A-N, though, isn't it? And not call Bangalore, but, you know, all these things are a bit politically correct, don't you think?
I think that, yes, but if you took the view that you're not going to change, you know, we'd still be calling Beijing Peking, and we'd still be calling Iran Persia, which actually the Daily Telegraph continued to do long after everyone else in the world was calling it Iran.
There are a few oddities, aren't there, in the style guide. We have for a long time not used the word actresses. We call everyone actors regardless of their gender, but then there was this famous piece about the film director Carlo Ponti, which was edited to say that in his early career he was, quote, already a man with a good eye for pretty actors.
Quite so. Well, that might have been true. I don't know.
I don't think it was. There was a correction, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. And to be serious, I think that the sub-editor in question took their eye off the ball there, and we do expect people to still
So for clarity, actresses is allowed if the meaning is altered.
Yes. I mean, that's the point. we don't generally lay down the law and put people in a straitjacket. How could we, when we have people like Simon Jenkins writing on the same page in the same edition as Charlie Brooker?
Thank you, David Marsh. Thank you very much. I love newspaper style guides. The recent Telegraph one that was issued was quite good because they've banned toffs, apparently.
They've banned toffs, but not from the newsroom.
Hey!
Good.
We're on form today, aren't we? Absolutely. Now, listen, if you've got any views about style, not mine, I should add, go to the blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. Join us in just a matter of seconds when John Plunkett will have miraculously appeared. Mr. Plunkett is here. How are you? How are you, John?
Well, I'm very good, thanks, mate.
Are you in good form?
Excellent form, yeah, especially excellent. I've been building up to this moment.
I bet you have. Well, we were just talking about newspaper style guides, and I see in your hand you have a leaked memo.
I do. I have in my hand a piece of paper.
Which is literally months old.
That's right, so it's hot off the press. It's hot off the printer. From the Sunday Express.
Yes, from the chief sub. Member from the sub.
Well, we think it's from a sub, yes. Right. We're not quite sure which one.
They probably haven't got a chief sub anymore.
No, exactly.
I think they are encouraging subbing and writing and job sharing.
They weren't happy with the previous edition, were they?
There was an award-winning issue, but for the wrong reasons. Yes, there's a long list of points, which I'm sure you'll be able to see on the Media Guardian website on Monkey Before Long. Yes, with raising a few issues, in the words of the email, it was riddled with appalling slapdash and lazy writing and subbing.
Well, which, more than usual.
Takes me back to my school days. so I'll give you a few highlights.
Go on.
Which was... this is on page 9, which if you've got your copy in front of you, in which he says, the conflict in Georgia provides us with some classic bollocks. This is not my words, obviously. What is a battle tank? Does this mean wars now have referees who decide whether or not a tank is allowed to go into battle? Also, what is a ground invasion? Is that one that comes after a sky invasion? But I think the ground invasion's a bit harsh, because you can have an air invasion. The Fergie and Andy story says they're in the Scottish Highlands, probably to make clear they're not in the English, Welsh or Lithuanian bloody Highlands. So it's clearly warming to his theme here.
Yep.
One here about a Jill Dando story, which makes a reference to a master assassin being captured. Earlier, we've been told how he failed to kill someone with 5 bullets. Not so masterful then.
Very high standards being maintained.
High standards, space, yeah. But it goes on and on. But it's almost more entertaining than the Sunday Express.
it is, yeah.
Page 12, the feature about Princess Margaret's party paradise on Mustique says that the island floats in a blue-green ocean.
but no island, not
even a super-duper one like Mustique, floats.
Why are they still writing about Princess Margaret 30 years after her death?
Is it to do with those photos?
It might have been.
I think I missed that issue. But no royals too dead for the Express.
Do you want to wrap up with a final quote?
I feel like rehash is not hyphenated. Probably isn't the big finish you were looking for, but it isn't.
Listen, let's move on, shall we? Moving swiftly on. What about Rich and Judy? Dear, down the dumper.
Yes, they didn't start with many viewers on their new show on Watch, which I think we've all seen advertised, but we haven't necessarily watched.
The trouble with Watch is that it's rather misnamed, isn't it?
It is. I think probably not watching, maybe. A Watch Plus One actually refers to the viewer, not the fact it's on an hour later. But I do have they did say, Richard and Judy said at the...
Have you got a statement?
But they did say at the TV festival in Edinburgh that they were prepared to lose a few viewers, but I don't know if they knew how many.
Yes, because, what is it, 100,000 or something like that?
But it dipped down to 53,000. For a second time out. But
Now, they are renaming other channels, aren't they, UK TV?
Yes, they are, yes.
In the same hilarious vein.
I'm sure they're both on your Sky favourite channels. Yes, UK TV People.
Right.
That is a channel, not people who work at UK TV.
Right.
And that's being renamed Blighty, which is because it's got a lot of British content, which is obviously unique to Blighty.
Yeah.
And another UK TV channel is becoming Eden.
Right. Is it going to have lots of naked women?
Hang on, I'm not sure.
And snakes.
Do I mean? I think
or is
I mean
it about a grey rain orchard.
Now, I could have done them a terrible disservice here by.
No, you're right. Possibly. It is Eden.
It is Eden. Thank goodness for that. But which channel is becoming Eden?
I think it's UK TV Style.
Right.
They've already got Dave.
Yes, this is the one that has Dave.
So, do these words mean something? Are they going to form a sentence?
Yeah. Yes.
Watch Dave. No.
No
maybe
one.
It doesn't work yet.
No. Richard, Judy. Yeah.
Is it now so irrelevant to work for any of these channels that you can literally spend all day at work doing anything you like? And so what happens as a consequence is that it's like, oh, and today we're going to rename the channel. That would have been a really massive deal at one point. And it's now kind of, it's like bizarre.
I think we should rename the Guardian website. Emily, what would you like to call the Guardian website?
Emily?
Steve. No, Emily obviously has a ring to it, but, you know, it's a bit self-aggrandising. I think it's Steve or Alex. We could rotate it on a daily basis.
Yeah, we could have different names every day. See, that would be new and original. Do you have anything else to talk about, John, before we get rid of you? What's this about the Google email?
I like this. This is a system that kicks in at a certain time of the day or night when you might have had a few drinks, and the email asks you, do you really mean to send this? And if you say
really?
Yes. Yeah, it's true. But not only that. I believe this is true. I might just have got up Wikipedia. No, I didn't. I got it off a newspaper. And it then asks you to do five simple arithmetic.
Does it ask you to I was going to say, does it ask you to walk a straight line?
No, it does. It asks you to do five easy sums, or quite difficult sums, right, in a limited amount of time. And if you get them wrong, you can't send your email.
Is this a blanket ban on emails, or do you have to turn it on?
I think you probably have to turn it on.
Right, okay. Right, well,
but I think it's a good idea. But people who are perhaps not too good at maths might never be able to send an email again after 10 o'clock at night.
Well, I was going to say, we're back around to our financially illiterate journalists again, aren't we? Which we were talking about right at the beginning. So I think at that point, I will say thank you very much to John Plunkett.
Thank you.
Thanks to James Robinson and to Emily Bell. I'm Matt Wells. The producer of Media Talk is Phil Maynard, and there'll be more soon. Bye.